backwards. His eyes were alight. A flash of his old mischief danced there.
"I know you will, little brother. Don't fear."
Then, in a leap of grace that belied his dog's years, he whipped away from me and became a grey streak that vanished suddenly amongst the scrubby brush and tussocky grasses of the gentle hillside. My eyes could not find him. So clever was he. But my heart went with him as it always did. My heart, I told myself, would always be able to find him, would always find a place where we still touched and merged. I sent the thought after him, but he made no reply to it. I returned to the cottage. I gathered the day's eggs from the chicken house and took them in, the full coddled eggs on the coals and the hearth fire while I brewed tea. We carried our food outside into the blue morning, and the fool and I broke our fast sitting on the porch. The wind off the water didn't reach my little vale. The leaves of the trees hung motionless. Only the chickens clucked and scratched in the dusty yard. I had not realized how prolonged my silence had been until the fool broke it. "It's pleasant here," he observed, waving his spoon at the surrounding trees. "The stream, the forest, the beech cliffs nearby, I can see why you prefer it to Buckkeep." He had always possessed a knack for turning my thoughts upside down. "I'm not sure that I prefer it," I replied slowly. "I never thought of comparing the two and then choosing where I would live. The first time I spent a winter here, it was because a bad storm caught us, and in seeking shelter under the trees, we found an old cart track. It led us to an abandoned cottage, this one, and we came inside." I shrugged a shoulder. "We've been here ever since." He cocked his head at me. "So, with all the wide world to choose from, you didn't choose at all. You simply stopped wondering one day."
"I suppose so." I nearly halted the next words that came from my lips, for they seemed to have no bearing on the topic. "Forge is just down the road from here."
"And it drew you here?"
"I don't think so. I did go back to it, to look at the ruins and recall it. No one lives there now. Usually, a place like that, folk would have scavenged the ruins. Not Forge.
Too many evil memories associated with that place," the fool confirmed.
"Forge was just the beginning, but folk remember it the best, and gave its name to the scourge that followed. I wonder how many folk were forged, all told."
I shifted uneasily, then rose to take the fool's empty dish. Even now I did not like to recall those days. The red ships had raided our shores for years, stealing our wealth. It was only when they had begun to steal the humanity of our people that we had risen in full wrath against them. They had begun that evil at Forge, kidnapping village folk and returning them to their kin as soulless monsters. Once it had been my task to track down and kill forged ones, one of many quiet, nasty tasks for the king's assassin. But that was years ago, I told myself. That Fitz no longer existed.
"It was a long time ago," I reminded the fool.
"It's over and done with now."
"So some say. Others disagree. Some still cling to their hatred of the Out-Islanders and say that even the dragons we sent them were too merciful. Others, of course, say we should put that war behind us, as six duchies and Out-Islanders have always moved from war to trade. On my way here, there was tavern talk that Queen Katrikan seeks to buy both peace and a trade alliance with the Out-Islanders. I've heard it said she will marry Prince Dutiful off to an Out-Islands Narcheska, to cement the treaty bond she has proposed."
"Narcheska?" He lifted his eyebrows.
"A sort of princess, I assume. At the very least, a daughter of some powerful noble."
"Well, so." I tried not to show how this news unsettled me. "It will not be the first time that diplomacy was secured in such a way. Consider how Katrikan came to be Verity's wife. To confirm our alliance with the Mountain Kingdom was the intent of that marriage, yet it worked out to be far more than that."
"It did indeed,"
the fool replied agreeably, but his neutral words left me pondering. I took our bowls inside and washed them out. I wondered how Dutiful felt about being used as barter to secure a treaty, then pushed the thought from my mind. Katrikan would have raised him in the mountain way to believe that the ruler was always the servant of the people. Dutiful would be, well, dutiful, I told myself. No doubt he would accept it without question, just as Cotricken had accepted her arranged marriage to Verity. I noted that the water barrel was nearly empty already. The fool had always been ardent in his washing and scrubbing, using 3 times as much water as any other man I knew. I picked up buckets and went outside. "I'm going to fetch more water." He hopped nimbly to his feet. "I'll come along." So he followed me, down the dapple-shaded path to the stream, and to the place I had dug out and lined with stone so that I could fill my buckets more easily. He took the opportunity to splash his hands clean and to drink deeply of the cold, sweet water. When he straightened up, he looked around suddenly. "Where is Night Eyes?" I stood up with the buckets, their weight balancing one another. "Oh, he likes to go off on his own sometimes. Then pain lanced through me. I dropped my brimming buckets and clutched at my throat. For an instant before I realized the discomfort was not my own, the fool's gaze met mine. His golden skin gone sallow, I think he felt a shadow of my fear. I reached for Night Eyes, found him, and set off at a run. I followed no path through the forest, and the underbrush caught at me. Seeking to bar my headlong flight, I crashed through it, heedless of my clothes and skin. The wolf could not breathe. His tortured gasping taunted my body's frantic gulping of air. I struggled to keep his panic from becoming my own. I drew my knife as I ran, ready for whatever enemy had attacked him. But when I burst from the trees into the clearing near the beaver pond, I saw him writhing alone by the shore. With one paw, he was clawing at his mouth. His jaws were stretched wide. Half of a large fish lay on the pebbled shore beside him. He backed jerkily in circles, shaking his head from side to side, trying to dislodge what choked him. I threw myself to my knees beside him. "Don't fight me," I begged him, but I do not think he could heed me. Red panic drenched his thoughts. I tried to put an arm around him to steady him, but he flung himself clear of me. He shook his head wildly, but could not clear his throat. I launched myself at him, throwing him to the ground. I landed on his ribs and inadvertently saved his life. The press of my body on his chest pushed the fish clogging his throat up into his mouth. Heedless of his teeth, I reached into his mouth and clawed it free. I flung it from us. I felt him gasp in a breath. I lifted my body off his. He staggered to his feet. I felt I did not have the strength to stand.
"Choking on fish!" I exclaimed, shakily. I might have known. Teach you to be so greedy in your gulping!"
I took a deep breath of my own, relieved beyond words. However, my relief was short-lived. The wolf stood, took 2 staggering steps, then collapsed brokenly onto the ground. He was no longer choking, but pain blossomed heavily inside him.
"What is it? What's wrong with him?"
the fool demanded behind me. I had not even been aware that he had followed me. I had no time for him now. I scrambled over to my companion. Fearfully, I set a hand to him and felt that touch amplify our bond. Pain squeezed him deep in his chest. It hurt so that he could scarcely breathe. His heart thundered unevenly in his ears. His parted eyelids revealed only the roll of his eyes. His tongue sprawled limply from his mouth.
"Night Eyes! My brother!"
I shouted the words, but I knew he scarcely heard them. I reached after him, willing my strength to him, and felt an unbelievable thing. He evaded me. He drew back from my reaching, refusing. As much as his weakness allowed him, that link we had shared so long. As he concealed his thoughts, I felt him slipping away from me into a greyness I could not penetrate. It was intolerable.
"No!"
I howled and flung my awareness after his. When I could not make the grey barrier yield to my wit, I skilled into it, heedlessly and instinctively, using every magic I possessed to reach him. And reach the wolf I did. I was suddenly within him, my consciousness meshed with his in a way I had never known before. His body was my own. Long years ago, when Regal had killed me, I had fled the battered husk of my own flesh and taken shelter within Night Eyes. I shared residence with the wolf in his body, perceiving his thoughts, seeing the world through his eyes. I had ridden with him, a passenger in his life. Eventually Burrick and Chade had called us both back to my graveside and restored me to my own cold flesh. This was not that. No. Now I had made his body my own. My human awareness overpowering his wolfness. I settled into him, and forced calm upon his frenzied struggling. I ignored his distaste for what I did. It was necessary, I told him. If I did not do this, he would die. He stopped resisting me, but it was not concession. Instead, it was as if he disdainfully abandoned what I had taken from him. I would worry about it later. Offending him was the least of my concerns. It was strange to be in his body that way, rather like donning another man's clothing. I was aware of every piece of him, nails to tail-tip. Air poured strangely over my tongue, and even in my distress the scents of the day spoke sharply to me. I could smell the sweat of my fit self nearby, and I was dimly aware of the fool crouching over that body, shaking it. I had no time for that now. I had discovered the source of this body's pain. It centered in my shuddering heart. My forcing calm on the wolf had already aided him somewhat, but the limping, uneven beat of his blood spoke ominously of something gone savagely wrong. Peering down into a cellar is very different from climbing down inside it and looking around. It is a poor explanation, but the best I can offer. From feeling the wolf's heart, I suddenly became the wolf's heart. I did not know how I did it. It was as if I leaned desperately against a locked door, knowing my salvation was on the other side, and that door suddenly gave way. I became his heart and knew my function in his body, and knew also that my function was impeded. Muscle had grown thin with age and weary. As heart, I steadied myself and sought feebly for a more even beat. When I achieved that, the press of pain eased and I went to work. Night Eyes had retreated to some far corner of our awareness. I let him sulk there, focusing only on what I must do. To what can I compare what I did? Weaving? Building a brick wall? Perhaps it was more like darning the worn heel of a sock. I sensed that I constructed, or rather reconstructed, that which had become weakened. I also knew that it was not I, Fitz, that did this, but rather that as part of a wolf's body, I guided that body through a familiar dance. With my focus, it did its task more swiftly. That was all, I told myself uneasily. Yet I sensed that somewhere someone must pay for this hastening of the body's work. When I felt the work was complete, I stepped back. I was heart no longer, but felt with pride its new strength and steadiness. Yet with that awareness came a sudden jolt of fear. I was not in my own body. I had no idea what had been happening to my own body all the while I had been within Night Eyes. I had no concept of how much time had passed. In perplexity, I reached for Night Eyes, but he held himself aloof from me. "I only did this to help you," I protested. He kept his silence. I could not tell his thoughts clearly, but his emotions were plain. He was as insulted and affronted as I had ever felt him. "Fine, then," I told him, icily. "Have it your way." Angrily, I withdrew. At least, I attempted to withdraw. Suddenly, everything was very confusing. I knew I had to go somewhere, but somewhere and go were not concepts that seemed to apply. It recalled me somewhat to the sensation of being caught unprepared in the full flood of skill. That river of magic could tatter an inexperienced user's self to threads, could unfurl a man across the waters of consciousness until he had no self-awareness left. This was different, in that I did not feel spread out and tattering, but trapped in a tangle of myself, bobbing in the current with nowhere to anchor myself save in Night Eye's body. I could hear the fool calling my name, but that did me no good, for I heard his voice with Night Eye's ears.
"You see," the wolf observed woefully. "See what you have done to us. I tried to warn you. I tried to keep you out."
"I can correct it," I asserted wildly. We both knew that I did not lie so much as frantically strive that my thought be true. I divorced myself from his body. I gave up his senses, refused touch and sight and hearing, denied the dust on my tongue and the scent of my nearby body. I pulled my awareness free of his, but then hung there, suspended. I did not know how to get back into my own body. Then I felt something, a tiny twitch, smaller than if someone had plucked a thread from my shirt. It reached for me, crawling out to me from my true body. To clutch at it was like snatching after a sunbeam. I struggled wildly to grasp it, then subsided back into my formless self, feeling that my snatching at it had only dispersed that faint sending. I held my awareness still and small, waiting as a cat lurks beside a mouse hole. The twitching came again, faint as moonlight through leaves. I forced myself to keep still, forced calmness on myself as I allowed it to find me. Like fine gold thread, it touched me at last. It probed me, and when it was sure of me, it picked at me, pulling me unevenly towards itself. The tug was insistent, yet it had no more strength than a hair. I could do nothing to aid it without destroying it. Instead, I must hang suspended, fearing that the touch would break as it drew me uncertainly away from the wolf and towards myself. Faster it drew me, and then, suddenly, I could flow of my own volition. I abruptly knew the cramped form of my own body. I poured into myself, horrified at how cold and stiff the physical confines of my soul had become. My eyes were sticky and dry from being open and unblinking. At first I could see nothing, nor could I speak, for my mouth and throat were likewise dried to leather. I tried to roll over, but my muscles were cramped and unyielding. I could do no more than writhe feebly. Yet even my pain was a blessing, for it was my own, the sensation of my own flesh connecting to my own mind. I gave a hoarse croak of relief. The fool's cupped hands trickled water over my lips and eventually down my throat. Sight came back to me, blurry at first, but enough to reveal that the sun was far past the noon. I had been out of my body for hours. After a time, I could sit up. I reached immediately for Nighteyes. He sprawled beside me still. He did not sleep. His state of unconsciousness was deeper than that. By touching him, I could sense him as a tiny mote of awareness buried deep. I felt the steady throb of his pulse and knew immense satisfaction. I nudged at his awareness. Go away. He was still angry with me. I could not care. His lungs worked. His heart beat steadily now. Exhausted as he was, disoriented as I was, still it was all worth it if his life had been saved. A time later I located the fool. He knelt beside me, his arm around my shoulders. I had not been aware of him steadying me. I wobbled my head to look at him. His face sagged with weariness and his brow was creased with pain, but he managed a lopsided smile. I did not know if I could do it, but it was the only thing I could think of to try. After a few moments, his words made sense to me. I looked down at my wrist. His fingerprints were renewed there, not silver as they were the first time he skill touched me, but a darker shade of grey than they had been for some time. The thread of awareness that linked us had become one strand stronger. I was appalled at what he had done. Thank you. I suppose. I offered the words ungraciously. I felt invaded. I resented that he had touched me in such a way, without my consent. It was childish, but I had not the strength to reach past it just then. He laughed aloud at me, but I could hear the edge of hysteria in it. I did not think you would like it, yet, my friend, I could not help myself. I had to do it. He drew ragged breath. His voice was softer as he added, And so it begins again already. Scarcely 2 days am I at your side and fate reaches for you. Will this always be the cost for us? Must I always dangle you over death's jaws in an effort to lure this world into a better course? His grip on my shoulders tightened. Ah, Fitz, how can you continually forgive what I do to you? I could not forgive it. I did not say so.
I looked away from him. I need a moment to myself, please. A bubble of silence met my words. Then, of course. He let his arm fall away from my shoulders and abruptly stood clear of me. It was a relief. His touch on me had been heightening the skill bond between us. It made me feel vulnerable. He did not know how to reach across it and plunder my mind, but that did not lessen my fear. A knife to my throat was a threat, even if the hand that held it had only the best of intentions. I tried to ignore the other side of that coin. The fool had no concept of how open he was to me just then. The sense of it taunted me, tempting me to attempt a fuller joining. All I would have to do is bid him lay his fingers once more on my wrist. I knew what I could have done with that touch. I could have swept across and into him, known all his secrets, taken all his strength. I could have made his body an extension of my own, used his life and his days for my own purpose. It was a shameful hunger to feel. I had seen what became of those who yielded to it. How could I forgive him for making me feel it? My skull throbbed with the familiar pain of a skill headache, while my body ached as if I had fought a battle. I felt raw to the world, and even his friend's touch chafed me. I lurched to my feet and staggered towards the water. I tried to kneel by the stream's edge, but it was easier to lie on my belly and suck water up into my parched mouth. Once my thirst was assuaged, I splashed my face. I rubbed the water over my face and hair, and then knuckled my eyes until tears ran. The moisture felt good, and my vision cleared. I looked at the slack body of my wolf, and then glanced at the fool. He stood small, his shoulders rounded, his mouth pinched tight. I had hurt him. I felt regret at that. He had intended only good, yet a stubborn part of me still resented what he had done. I sought for some justification to cling to that stupidity. There was none. Nevertheless, sometimes knowing one has no right to be angry does not disperse all the anger. "That's better," I said, and shook the water from my hair, as if I could convince us both that only my thirst had troubled me. The fool made no reply. I took a double handful of water to the wolf and sat by him to let it trickle over his still lolling tongue. After a bit he stirred feebly, enough to pull his tongue back into his mouth. I made another effort for the fool. "I know that you did what you did to save my life. Thank you."
"He saved both our lives. He spared us continuing in a way that would have destroyed us both."
The wolf did not open his eyes, but his thought was strong with passion. "However, what he did..."
"Was it worse than what you did to me?"
I had no answer for that. I could not be sorry that I had kept him alive, yet it was easier to speak to the fool than follow that thought. "You saved both our lives. I had gone, somehow, I had gone inside Night Eyes. With the skill, I think." A flash of insight broke my words. Was this what Chade had spoken of to me, that the skill could be used to heal? I shuddered. I had imagined it as a sharing of strength, but what I had done... I pushed the knowledge away. I had to try and save him. And I did help him, but then I could not find my way out of him. If you hadn't drawn me back... I let the words trail off. There was no quick way to explain what he had rescued us from. I knew now, with certainty, that I would tell him the tale of our year among the old blood. "Let's go back to the cabin. There is elf bark there for tea, and I need to rest as much as Night Eyes does." "And I also," the fool acceded faintly. I glanced over him, noting the grey pallor of fatigue that drooped his face and the deep lines clenched in his brow. Guilt washed through me. Untrained and unaided, he had used the skill to pull me back into my own body. The magic was not in his blood as it was in mine. He had no hereditary predilection for it. All he had possessed was the ancient skill marks on his fingers, the memento of his accidental brush against Verity's skill-encrusted hands. That, and the feeble bond we had once shared through that touch, were his only tools, as he had risked himself to draw me back. Neither fear nor ignorance had stopped him. He had not known the full danger of what he did. I could not decide if that made his act less brave or more so. And all I had done was rebuke him for it. I recalled the first time that Verity had used my strength to further his own skill. I had collapsed from the drain of it. Yet the fool still stood, swaying slightly, but he stood, and he made no complaint of the pain that must be playing hammer and tongs on his brain. Not for the first time I marvelled at the toughness that resided in his slender body. He must have sensed my eyes on him, for he turned his gaze to mine. I attempted a smile. He answered it with a wry grimace. Night Eyes rolled onto his belly, then lurched to his feet. Wobbly as a new foal, he tottered to the water and drank. Satisfying his thirst made both of us feel better, yet my legs still trembled with weariness. "It's going to be a long walk back to the cabin," I observed. The fool's voice was neutral, yet almost normal, as he asked,
"Can you make it?"
"With some help." I held my hand up to him, and he came to take it and draw me to my feet. He held my arm and walked beside me, but I think he leaned on me more than I did on him. I set my teeth and my resolve and did not reach out to him through that skill link that hung between us like a silver chain. I could resist that temptation, I told myself. Verity had, so could I. The fool broke the sun-dappled silence of the forest. "I thought you were having a seizure at first, as used to fail you, but then you lay so still. I feared you were dying. Your eyes were open and staring. I could not find your pulse, but every now and then your body would twitch and gasp in some air." He paused. "I could get no response from you. It was the only thing I could think of to do, to plunge in after you." His words horrified me. I was not sure that I wanted to know what my body did when I was out of it. It was probably the only way to save my life. "And mine," he said quietly. "For despite what it costs either of us, I must keep you alive. You are the wedge I must use, Fitz. And for that, I am sorrier than I can ever say." He turned his head as he spoke to me. The openness of that golden gaze combined with the bond between us, gold and silver twining, I recognized and rejected a truth I did not want to know. Behind us, the wolf paced slowly, his head hanging. Chapter 8. Old Blood. "And I trust the hounds will reach you in good health along with this missive. If it be otherwise, please have a bird sent me with such tidings that I may advise you as to their care. In closing, I ask that you please pass on my regards to Lord Chivalry Farseer. Inform him with my greetings that the colt he entrusted to my care still suffers from too abrupt a weaning from his dam. In nature, he is skittish and suspicious, but we shall hope that gentle treatment and patience coupled with a firm hand will cure him of this. He has also a stubborn streak, most vexatious to his trainer, but this, I believe, we may attribute to his sharing his sire's temperament. Discipline may supplant it with strength of spirit. I remain, as always, his most humble servant. My best wishes also to your mistress and children, Talman, and I will look forward when next you come to Buckkeep to settling our wager regarding my vixen's tenacity on a scent as opposed to your stub-tail. Burrick, Stablemaster, Buckkeep." From a missive sent to Talman, Stablemaster, Withywoods. By the time we reached the cabin, darkness threatened the edges of my vision. I gripped the fool's slender shoulder and steered him towards the door. He stumbled up the steps. The wolf followed us. I pushed the fool towards a chair, and he dropped into it. Night Eyes went straight to my bedchamber and clambered up onto my bed. He made a brief show of rucking up the blankets, then settled into it and dropped into a limp sleep. I quested towards him with the wit, but found him closed to me. I had to be content with watching the rhythmic rise and fall of his ribs as I built up the fire and put a kettle on to boil. Each step of the simple task required all my concentration. The thundering of pain in my head demanded I simply drop in my tracks, yet I could not allow myself to do that. At the table, the fool had pillowed his head on his arms, the picture of misery.
As I took down my supply of elf bark, he rolled his head to watch me. The fool made a face at his bitter memory of the dark, dried bark.
"So, you keep a supply at hand, do you?"
His question came out as a croak. "I do," I conceded, measuring out the bark. I began to grind it with a mortar and pestle. As soon as some was powdered, I dipped my finger into it and touched it to the side of my tongue. I felt a brief easing of the pain.
"And you use it often?"
"Only when I must." He took a deep breath and let it out. Then he stood reluctantly and found mugs for both of us. When the water boiled, I prepared a strong pot of elf bark tea. The drug would ease the headache of skilling, but leave behind both a jittery restlessness and a morose spirit. I had heard tales that the slave owners of Chalced gave it to their slaves to increase their stamina at the same time that it drained their will to escape. Using elf bark is said to become a habit, but I have never found it so. Perhaps regular forced use of it could create a craving, but my own use of it has always been as a remedy. It is also said to extinguish the ability to skill in the young and to cripple its growth for older skill users. That I might have considered a blessing, but my experience has been that elf bark can deaden the ability to skill without easing the craving to do so. I poured two mugs of it after the bark had steeped, and sweetened both with honey. I thought of going to the garden for mint. It seemed much too far away. I set a mug before the fool and took a seat across from him. He lifted his mug in a mocking toast.
"To us, the White Prophet and his catalyst."
I lifted mine. "The fool and the fits," I amended his words, and touched my mug to his. I took a sip. The elf bark spread bitterness all through my mouth. As I swallowed it, I felt my throat tighten in its wake. The fool watched me drink, then took a mouthful of his own. He grimaced at it, but almost immediately the lines in his brow relaxed somewhat. He frowned at his mug.
"Is there no other way to get the benefit of this?"
I grinned sourly. I was desperate enough once to simply chew the bark. It cut the insides of my cheeks to ribbons and left my mouth so puckered with bitterness I could scarcely drink water to get rid of the taste.
"Ah."
He added another liberal dollop of honey to his, drank from the mug, and scowled. A little silence fell. The edge of uneasiness hovered between us still. No apology would clear it, but perhaps an explanation would. I glanced over at the wolf sleeping on my bed. I cleared my throat. "Well, after we left the Mountain Kingdom, we journeyed back to the borders of Buck." The fool lifted his eyes to mine. He propped his chin on one hand and looked at me, giving me his absolute and silent attention. He waited as I found my words. They did not come easily. Slowly I strung together for him the tale of those days. Night Eyes and I had not hurried our journey. It took us the better part of a year of wandering by a very roundabout path through the mountains and across the wide plains of Farrow before we returned to the vicinity of Crow's Neck in Buck. Autumn had just begun her warnings when we reached the low-roofed log and stone cabin built into the rise of the forested hill. The great evergreen stood impervious to autumn's threats, but frosts had just touched the leaves of the small bushes and plants that grew on the mossy roof, outlining some in yellow and blushing others to red. The wide door stood open to the cool afternoon, and a ripple of near-invisible smoke rose from the squat chimney. There was no need to knock or call. The old blood folk within knew we were there, as surely as I could sense that both Rolf and Holly were within. Unsurprised, Black Rolf came to the threshold. He stood in the cavernous dark of his cabin and frowned out at us.
"So, you finally realized you need to learn what I can teach you," he greeted us. The stink of bear hung about the place, making both Night Eyes and me uneasy. Yet I still had nodded. He laughed aloud, and his welcoming grin divided the forest of his black beard. I had forgotten the size of the hulking man. He lumbered out and engulfed me in a friendly hug that nearly cracked my ribs. Almost I felt the thought he sent to Hilda, the bear that was his bond animal.
"Old blood welcomes old blood." Holly emerged to greet us gravely. Rolf's wife was as slender and quiet as I recalled her. Her whitbeast, Sleet, rode on her wrist. The hawk fixed me with one bright eye, then took flight as she drew closer to us. She smiled and shook her head to watch him go. Her greeting was more restrained than Rolf's, yet somehow warmer. "Well met and welcome," she offered us. She turned her head slightly and sent us a sideways glance from her dark eyes. A quick smile lit her face, even as she ducked her head to conceal it. She stood beside Rolf as slight as he was broad. She preened her short, sleek hair back from her face. "Come within and share food," she invited.
"And then we shall take a walk, find a good place for your den, and start building it," Rolf offered, blunt and direct as always.
He glanced up through the forest roof at the overcast sky.
"Winter draws nigh. You were foolish to delay so long."
And as simply as that, we became part of the Witted folk that lived in the area outlying Crow's Neck. They were forest dwellers, going into the town only for those things they could not make for themselves. They kept their magic concealed from the town dwellers, for to be witted was to invite the rope and the blade to your door. Not that Rolf and Holly or any of the others referred to themselves as witted. That was the epithet flung by those that both hated and feared beast magic. It was a taunt to be hung by. Amongst themselves they spoke of their kind as old blood, and pitied any children born to them who could not bond with an animal, mind and spirit, as ordinary folk might pity a child born blind or deaf. There were not many of the old blood, no more than 5 families, spread far and wide in the forests about Crow's Neck. Persecution had taught them not to dwell too closely together. They recognized one another, and that was enough community for them. Old blood families generally practiced the solitary trades that permitted them to live apart from ordinary folk, and yet close enough to barter and enjoy the benefits of a town. They were woodcutters and fur trappers and the like. One family lived with their otters near a clay bank and made exquisitely graceful pottery. One old man bonded with a boar, lived amply on the coin the richer folk of the town paid him for the truffles he foraged. By and large, they were a peaceful folk. A people who accepted their roles as members of the natural world without disdain. It could not be said that they felt the same about humanity in general. From them I heard and sensed much disapproval for folk that lived cheek by jowl in the towns and thought of animals as mere servants or pets, dumb beasts. They disparaged, too, those of old blood who lived amongst ordinary folk and denied their magic to do so. Often it was assumed I came of such a family, and it was difficult to dispel such ideas without revealing too much of the truth about myself.
"And did you succeed in that?"
the fool asked quietly. I had the uneasy feeling he was asking the question because he knew I had not. I sighed. In fact, that was the most difficult line I walked. In the months that passed, I wondered if I had not made a great error in coming back amongst them. Years before, when I had first met them, Rolf and Holly had known that my name was Fitz. They had known, too, of my hatred for Regal. From that knowledge to identifying me as Fitz the Wit Bastard was a tiny step. I knew that Rolf took it, for he attempted to talk of it with me one day. I told him flatly that he was mistaken, that it was a great and unfortunate coincidence both of name and bond beast that had caused me a great deal of trouble in my lifetime. I was so adamant on the point that even that blunt soul soon realized he would never badger me into admitting otherwise. I lied, and he knew I lied, but I made it clear that it must be taken as truth between us, and so we left it. Holly, I am certain, knew as much, but never spoke of it. I did not think the others in the community made the connection. I introduced myself as Tom, and so they all called me, even Holly and Rolf. Fitz, I prayed, would stay dead and buried.
So they knew.
The fool confirmed his suspicion.
That group, at least, knew that Fitz, Chivalry's bastard, did not die.
I shrugged a shoulder. It surprised me that the old epithet still stung as it did, even from his lips. Surely I had grown past that. Once I had thought of myself only as the bastard, but I had long ago got past that and realized that a man was what he made of himself, not what he was born. I recalled suddenly how the hedge witch had puzzled over my disparate palms. I resisted the impulse to look at my own hands and instead poured us both more of the elf bark brew. Then I rose to rummage through my larder to see what I could find to drive the bitter taste from my mouth. I picked up the sand sedge brandy, then determinedly set it back again. Instead, I found the last of the cheese, a bit hard, but still flavorful, and half a loaf of bread. We had not eaten since breaking our fast that morning. Now that my headache was quieting, I found myself ravenously hungry. The fool shared my appetite, for as I whittled hunks off the cheese, he sliced thick slabs off the bread. My story hung unfinished in the air between us. I sighed. There was little I could do about what they knew or didn't know, save deny it. Night Eyes and I needed what they knew. They alone could teach us what we had to learn. He nodded, and stacked cheese on top of bread before biting into it. He waited for me to continue. The words came to me slowly. I did not like to recall that year. Nonetheless, I learned much, not just from Rolf's deliberate teaching, but by simple exposure to the Old Blood community. Rolf was not the best of teachers. He was short-tempered and impatient, especially around mealtimes, much inclined to cuff and growl and sometimes roar his frustration at a slow student. He simply could not grasp how completely ignorant I was of Old Blood ways and customs. I suppose by his lights I was as ill-mannered as a deliberately rude child. My loud wit conversations with Night Eyes spoiled hunting for other bonded predators. I had never known that we must announce our presence through the wit if we shifted territory. In my days at Buckkeep, I had never even known that community existed amongst the witted ones, let alone that they had customs of their own. Wait, the fool interrupted me. Then you are saying that witted ones can share thoughts with each other just as thoughts can be exchanged through the skill? He seemed very excited at the idea. No, I shook my head. It's not like that. I can sense if another witted one is speaking with his bond beast, if they are careless and free in their conversing, as Night Eyes and I used to be. Then I will be aware of the wit being used, even though I am not privy to the thoughts they share. It's like the humming of a harp string. I smiled, ruefully. That was how Burrick kept guard on me, to be sure I was not indulging in the wit once he was aware I had it. He kept his own walls firm against it. He did not use it, and he tried to screen himself from the beasts that reached towards him with it. For a long time, that kept him ignorant of my use of it. He had set wit walls, similar to the skill walls that Verity taught me to set, but once he realized I was witted, I think he lowered them to oversee me. I paused at the fool's puzzled gaze. Do you understand? Not completely, but enough to take your meaning. But can you overhear another witted one's beast speaking to that witted one, then? I shook my head again, then nearly laughed at his baffled look. It seems so natural to me, it is difficult to put it into words. I pondered a bit. Imagine that you and I shared a personal language, one that only we two could interpret. Perhaps we do, he offered with a smile. I continued doggedly. The thoughts that Night Eyes and I share are our thoughts, and largely incomprehensible to anyone who overhears us using the wit. That language has always been our own, but Rolf taught us to direct our thoughts specifically to one another, rather than flinging out our wit wide to the world. Another witted one might be aware of us if he were specifically listening for us, but generally, our communication now blends with all the wit whispering of the rest of the world. The fool's brow was furrowed. So only Night Eyes can speak to you. Night Eyes speaks most clearly to me. Sometimes another creature, not bonded to me, will share thoughts with me, but the meaning is usually hard to follow, rather like trying to communicate with someone who speaks a foreign but similar language. There can be much hand-waving and raised voices, repeating words and gesturing. One catches the gist of the meaning with none of the niceties. I paused and pondered. I think it is easier if the animal is bonded to another witted one. Rolf's bear spoke to me once, and a ferret. And between Night Eyes and Burrick, it must have been oddly humiliating to Burrick, but he let Night Eyes speak to him when I was in Regal's dungeons. The understanding was imperfect, but it was good enough that Burrick and he could plot together to save me. I wandered for a time in that memory, then pulled myself back to my tale. Rolf taught me the basic courtesy of the Old Blood folk, but he did not teach us gently.
He was as prone to chastise before we were aware of our errors as afterwards. Nighteyes was more tolerant of him than I was, perhaps because he was more amenable to a pack hierarchy. I think it was more difficult for me to learn from him, for I had grown accustomed to a certain amount of adult dignity. Had I come to him younger, I might have accepted more blindly the roughness of his teaching. My experiences of the last few years had left me violent towards any person who showed aggression towards me. I think the first time I snarled back at him after he shouted at me for some error, it shocked him. He was cold and distant with me for the remainder of the day, and I perceived I must bow my head to his rough ways if I were to learn from him. So I did. But it was like learning to control my temper all over again. As it was, I was often hard-pressed to quell my anger towards him. His impatience with my slowness frustrated me as much as my human thinking baffled him. On his worst days he reminded me of the skillmaster Galen, and he seemed as narrow-minded and cruel as he spoke spitefully of how badly educated I had been amongst the unblooded. I resented that he should speak so of folk that I regarded as my own. I knew, too, that he thought me a suspicious and distrustful man who never completely lowered all my barriers to him. I held back much from him, that is true. He demanded to know of my upbringing, of what I could recall from my parents, of when I had first felt my old blood stir in me. None of the sparse answers I gave him pleased him, and yet I could not go into detail without betraying too much of whom and what I had been. The little I did tell him provoked him so much that I'm sure a fuller tale would have disgusted him. He approved that Burrick had prevented me from bonding young, and yet condemned all his reasons for doing so. That I had still managed to form a bond with Smithy despite Burrick's watchfulness convinced him of my deceitful nature. Repeatedly he came back to my wayward childhood as a root of all my problems in finding my old blood magic. Again, he reminded me of Galen disparaging the bastard for trying to master the skill, the magic of kings. Among a folk where I had thought finally to find acceptance, I discovered that yet again I was neither fish nor fowl. If I complained to Nighteyes at how he treated us, Rolf would snarl at me to stop whimpering to my wolf and apply myself to learning better ways. Nighteyes learned more easily, and often the wolf was the one to convey finally to me what Rolf had failed to rattle into me. Nighteyes also sensed more strongly than I did how much Rolf pitied me. The wolf did not react well to that, for Rolf's pity was based on the notion that I did not treat Nighteyes as well as I should. He took it amiss that I had been almost a grown man, and Nighteyes little more than a cub at the time of our bonding. Over and over, Rolf rebuked me for treating Nighteyes as less than an equal, a distinction that both of us disputed. The first time Rolf and I butted heads over it was the fashioning of our winter home. We selected a site convenient to Rolf and Holly's home, yet isolated enough that we would not intrude on one another. That first day, I began to build a cabin, whilst Nighteyes went hunting. When Rolf dropped by, he rebuked me for forcing Nighteyes to live in a dwelling that was entirely human. The structure of his own home incorporated a natural cave in the hillside, and was designed to be as much bear den as man house. He insisted that Nighteyes should dig a den into the hill face, and that I must then build my hut and incorporate it. When I conferred on this with Nighteyes, he replied he'd been accustomed to human dwellings since he was a pup, and he saw no reason why I should not do all the work to make a comfortable place for both of us. When I conveyed this to Rolf, he vented his temper at both of us explosively, telling Nighteyes he found nothing humorous in his surrendering his nature for the selfish comfort of his partner. It was so far from what either of us felt about the situation that we very nearly left Crow's Neck right then. Nighteyes was the one who decided we must stay and learn. We followed Rolf's directions, and Nighteyes laboriously excavated a den for himself, and I built my hut around the mouth of it. The wolf spent very little time in the den, preferring the warmth of my fireside, but Rolf never discovered that. Many of my disagreements with Rolf shared those same roots. He saw Nighteyes as too humanized, and shook his head at how little of wolf there was in me. Yet at the same time he warned us both that we had twined ourselves too tightly together, that he could find no place where he could sense one of us and not the other. Perhaps the most valuable thing Rolf taught us was how to separate from one another. Through me, he conveyed to Nighteyes the need that each of us had for privacy in matters such as mating or grieving. I had never been able to convince the wolf that the need for such a sundering existed. Again,
Night Eyes learned it more swiftly and better than I did. When he so desired, he could vanish completely from my senses. I did not enjoy the sensation of being isolated from him. I felt halved by it, and sometimes as less than a half. And yet we both saw the wisdom of it, and strove to perfect our abilities in that area. Yet no matter how satisfied we were with our progress, Rolf remained adamant that even in our separations we still shared a unity so basic that neither of us were even aware of it anymore. When I tried to shrug it off as inconsequential, he became almost incensed.
"And when one of you dies, what then? Death comes to all of us sooner or later, and it cannot be cheated. Two souls cannot long abide in one body before one takes control, and the other becomes but a shadow. It is a cruelty, no matter which becomes the stronger. Hence, all old blood traditions shun such greedy snatching at life."
Here, Rolf frowned at me most severely. Did he suspect I had already sidestepped my death once by such a ruse? He could not, I promised myself. I returned his gaze guilelessly. He knit his dark brows ominously.
"When a creature's life is over, it is over. It perverts all nature to extend it, yet old blood alone knows the true depth of agony when two souls that have been joined are parted by death. So it must be. You must be able to separate into yourselves when that time comes."
He beetled his heavy brows at us as he spoke. Night Eyes and I both grew still of thought, considering it. Even Rolf finally seemed to sense how much it distressed us. His voice grew gruffer, yet kinder.
"Our custom is not cruel. At least no crueler than it must be. There is a way to keep a remembrance of all that has been shared, a way to keep the voice of the other's wisdom and the love of the other's heart."
"So one partner could go on living without the other?" I asked, confused.
Rolf shot me a disgusted look. "No! I have just told you we do not do that. When your time comes to die, you should separate yourself from your partner and die, not seek to leech onto his life."
Night Eyes made a brief whistle of whine. He was as confused as I was. Rolf seemed to concede that he was teaching a difficult concept, for he stopped and scratched his beard noisily.
"It's like this. My mother is long dead and gone, but I can recall still the sound of her voice singing me a lullaby, and hear the warnings she would give when I try to do something foolish, right?"
"I suppose so," I conceded. This was another sore spot between Rolf and me. He had never accepted that I had no memories of my natural mother, although I had spent the first 6 years of my life with her. At my lukewarm response, he narrowed his eyes.
"As can most folks," he went on more loudly, as if sound alone could persuade me. "And that is what you can have when Night Eyes is gone. Or what he can keep of you."
"Memories," I agreed, quietly, nodding. Even discussing Night Eyes' death was unsettling.
"No!" Rolf exclaimed. "Not just memories. Anyone can have memories, but what a bonded one leaves behind for his partner is deeper and richer than memories. It's a presence. Not living on in the other's mind, not sharing thoughts, decisions, and experiences, but just being there, standing by. So now you understand," he informed me heavily.
"No," I started to say, but Night Eyes leaned heavily against my leg, so I simply made a sound that might have been agreement. And over the next month, Rolf instructed us in his dogged way, bidding us separate and then allowing us to come back together, but only in a thin, insubstantial way. I found it completely unsatisfactory. I was convinced we were doing something wrong, that this could not be the comfort and being that Rolf had spoken about. When I expressed my doubts to Rolf, he surprised me by agreeing with me, but then went on to declare that we were still far too intertwined, that the wolf and I must separate even more. And we gave heed to him, and sincerely tried, but held our own counsel as to what we would actually do when death came for one of us. We never voiced our obstinacy, but I am sure Rolf was aware of it,
He took great pains to prove to us the error of our ways, and the examples he showed us were truly wrenching. A careless old blood family had let swallows nest in their eaves where their infant son could not only hear their familial twitterings, but watch their comings and goings. And that was all he did, even now, as a grown man of about 30. In Buckkeep town, folk would have called him simple, and so he was. But when Rolf bade us reach towards him more discriminatingly with the wit, the reason was clear to us both. The boy had bonded not just to a swallow, but to all swallows. In his mind he was a bird, and his dabbling in mud and fluttering hands and snapping after insects were the work of his bird's mind.
"And that's what comes of bonding too young," Rolf told us darkly.
There was one other pair he showed us, but only from a distance. On an early morning, when mist lay heavy in the vales, we lay on our bellies on the lip of a dell, and made no sound nor thought amongst ourselves. A white hind drifted through the fog towards a pond, walking not with a deer's true caution, but with a woman's languid grace. I knew her partner must be close by, concealed in the mist. The deer lowered her muzzle to the water and drank long, slow draughts of the coolness. Then she slowly lifted her head. Her large ears swiveled forwards. I felt the tentative brush of her questing. I blinked, trying to focus on her, while the wolf made a small, questioning whine in the back of his throat. Rolf rose abruptly, showing himself disdainfully. He coldly refused the contact. I sensed his disgust as he strode away, but we remained staring down at her. Perhaps she sensed ambivalence, for she watched us with a very undeer-like boldness. An odd moment of vertigo washed over me. I squinted, trying to make the shape before me resolve into the two that my wit told me were there. When I was Chade's apprentice, he used several exercises to teach me to see what my eyes truly beheld, not what my mind expected me to see. Most were simple drills, to look at a tangle of line and decide if it were knotted or merely flung down, or to glance at a jumble of gloves and know which ones lacked mates. A more peculiar trick he showed me was to write the name of a colour in a mismatched ink, the word red painted in bright blue letters, to read a list of such colours correctly, saying the printed word rather than the colour of the inked letters, took more concentration than I had expected it would. And so I rubbed my eyes and looked again, and saw only a deer. The woman had been an expectation of my mind, based on my wit. Physically, she was not there. Her presence inside the hind distorted my wit sense of the deer. I shuddered away from the wrongness of it. Rolf had left us behind. In confusion, Night Eyes and I hastened after Rolf as he strode away from the sheltered dell and the quiet pool. Some time and distance later, "What was that?" I asked him. He rounded on me, affronted by my ignorance.
"What was that? That was you, a dozen years hence, if you do not mend your ways. You saw her eyes. That was no deer down there, but a woman in the skin of a hind. It's what I wanted you to see. The wrongness of it. The complete perversion of what should have been shared trust."
I looked at him quietly, waiting. I think he had expected me to concur with his judgment, for he made a deep noise in his throat.
"That was Delaina, who slipped through the ice into Marple Pond and drowned 2 winters ago. She ought to have died right then, but no. She clung to Perella. The hind either hadn't the heart or the strength to oppose her. Now, there they are, a deer with the mind and heart of a woman, and Perella, with scarcely a thought to call her own. It goes against all nature, it does. Ones like Delaina are at the root of all the evil talk the unblooded wag on about us. She's what makes them want to hang us and burn us over water. She deserves such treatment."
I looked away from his vehemence. I'd come too close to that fate myself to believe anyone could deserve it. My body had lain cold in my grave for days while I'd shared Night Eye's flesh and life. I was certain then that Rolf suspected as much of me. I wondered then, if he so despised me, why he taught me at all. As if he had caught some whiff of my thought, he added gruffly,
"Anyone untaught can do a wrong thing. But after he's been taught, there's no excuse to repeat it, none at all."
He turned and strode off down the path. We trailed after him, Night Eye's tail